are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, July 30th, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, it's debate night number one preview. Today, because it's debate night, it's the second debate first night, 2.1 tonight. Boom. Also on the program today, Trump's intel director is an unqualified liar, as opposed to the qualified liars who should be in that job. Republicans marinating in the racism of their party. More Democrats on board with impeachment, both in the Senate and the House, in the wake of the Mueller testimony. And is Donald Trump's racist attack versus Cummings a function of Cummings' investigation in Trump Inc.'s involvement in a Saudi nuke plan? Meanwhile, President Stephen Miller wants ICE to adjudicate asylum claims. This judge is too weak. Senate fails to override the Trump veto on the restrictions on Saudi arms sales. Trump's food stamp assault could also end up axing free lunches for 500,000 kids. Dems wake up to the massive hill that is a Senate takeover. And meanwhile, many Democratic incumbents are getting challengers as the DCCC implodes. And how many times are we supposed to be okay with data breaches? Apparently, all of them. And forever. And lastly, congratulations. We have hit the tipping point. Afghan and NATO forces have now, in the first half of 2019, killed more civilians than anyone else. We've killed more civilians than we have actual fighters, and managed to kill more civilians than even the Taliban. So, good on you, folks. Only took us about 20 years to get there. But we got there. Everybody pat yourselves on the shoulders. All this and more on today's program. Oh, ladies and gentlemen, I should tell you this right up front. We are going to do a shorter free show today. So if you are listening via the podcast, of course, if you're listening live, watching live, you will see all of it. But if you're listening via the podcast, it'll be a shortened audio podcast today. We will move into the fun half, wherein we'll have something a little bit different, sort of a throwback. It's a throwback Tuesday around here. I don't know if I would call this a debate. Maybe it'll end up being a debate. I suspect it might be. We may be debating certain topics, but I will be talking to the 19th and current chair of the Libertarian National Committee. We will, this is part of my listening and talking tour, to determine whether I should throw my hat into the Libertarian 2020 sweeps, as it were.
I think this is an intellectual curiosity expedition.
That's correct. I will be talking to Nicholas Sarwark, about my prospects, perhaps. I'm not quite sure. We haven't, we just, it was out there, and so we just, we said yes. Sometimes that's the way that we program around here. We just walk around, bump into walls, and then sometimes say yes.
Like always improv. Say yes.
Hi, do you believe that water shouldn't be treated? Oh, great. Call in my program.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. So we will be talking to Nicholas in a bit. And I should also tell you that tonight we will be covering the debates live. The best thing to do, you know, because is to go to majority.fm on the homepage. We will have a link to where we're doing this. But we will most likely be streaming live to Twitch. Twitch is available to everyone. And you can, I don't even know if you have to sign up for it. You just go on it. And you have to sign up, I think, if you're going to stream. But so you can just watch there. The experience is very much like YouTube. Arguably, I don't know. Is it cooler? I don't know.
Sure.
It's a totally different, it's the people who stream on Twitch, they, I used to think that I had stamina. Because I have once done, what do we do, a 12-hour show? Were you for that?
No, I wasn't.
I did a 12-hour show. Jeez. And back in the radio days, I would do 7 hours full stop radio. Now, that's exhausting. But these men and women on Twitch, they'll do like 7-8 hours a day, 6 days a week.
Well, this is why I've been trying to push a message to take gamers seriously, because they do have impressive stamina.
And so then
in gaming.
And then what happens?
Just take them. Just watch their Twitch.
Watch their Twitch.
Yeah, I've watched Hassan Piker's Twitch. To be fair, though, sometimes he's just like doing things around his house or playing basketball. Well, people eat it up, though. They want to watch him.
Fair enough. But be that as it may, we will be streaming on Twitch tonight. We will have full debate coverage. And tomorrow we will provide for you a recap of the debate tonight. And then we will be back to cover the second night of the debate. I will get into the debate stuff tonight, but before we get to that, just want to remind you how not racist Donald Trump is. We know he's not racist because he told us, and here he is. He is on the White House lawn, and it turns out he is one of the least racist people in the world.
I am the least racist person there is anywhere in the world. When con men, who I've known almost all my business life, because I had to deal with them, unfortunately, in New York. But I got
pause it for 1 second. Now, he was talking about, he's known Al Sharpton almost all his business life. Now, I thought he had said, if you didn't hear the Sharpton, that almost, I've been the least racist person for almost my entire business life, because there was that little thing where they had to get 2 consent decrees from the Department of Justice for stop being so racist in your housing policies.
Yeah, but we didn't have Barr there at the time.
Right, we had no idea, so.
With him, Al Sharpton. Now, he's a racist. He's a racist. But when people, let me explain to you. What I've done for African Americans in 2.5 years, no president has been able to do anything like it.
There you go, African Americans. He's the great white hope, as Jesse Lee Peterson would say.
There's a great exchange among, I mean, all of the exchanges with Cornel West are great, but he told a very funny. Rogan asked him if he ever met Trump. And he said that he did meet Trump briefly, I think, in the 80s or early 90s at some show in Las Vegas. And Cornell, I mean, he threaded basically a broader argument about what patriotism is and immigration and the black experience. But he just had a very funny rundown of how excited Trump was to be in a room of black people because it made him feel cool.
Right.
And that was his distinct memory of Trump. And yeah, that's like Trump's sort of MO is like this. That's why I feel like it's so Queens. It's so New York, because it's so vilely racist and then also like, hey, what's up, hip cat? Let me come uptown. You know, Cornel West really explained that well.
Pass the watermelon, mo effer.
No, but it would almost be like, Bill O'Reilly doesn't get it.
He doesn't get it.
These are my cats.
Look, here is Donald Trump explaining a little bit more.
Because the African-American people have been calling the White House. They have never been so happy as what a president has done.
The African-American people have been calling the White House. I'm not sure how that works exactly. Like, is it that party app? Is there a party app where everybody lines up? But there it is, Donald Trump, the least racist person. And this is relevant because it will... there's a couple of polling out today. Now, look, who knows, right? I mean, we don't know this stuff. But there is indications that this is going to hurt Trump. This seems to be the game plan. And he's going to keep looking for these opportunities in which to basically string that racist flag up. There was no doubt, right, that in 2018, the hardcore racists just didn't show up. Republicans had a better turnout than they've had in the past. Democrats had an even better turnout than they've had in the past. Donald Trump will motivate those people to come out. However, there is data. There's two data points that I want you to that I've seen. One is a report that, for whatever reason, this explicit of racism is turning off, and Trump is beginning to lose non-college educated white women. No, I mean,
I didn't start anything with the wife.
And I'm not quite clear what it is that why all of a sudden this racism, but people suspect that it may have something to do with the kids, but the racism in and of itself seems to be so blatant. The non-college white guys, they're all in. This motivates them to vote. Not all white guys.
Non-college. I'm less triggered by the white guys
whatever.
Than the non-college. Educated.
Not all
just
white guys.
Careful.
Not all non-college. I'm talking broad strokes. Not all. Not even probably the majority of non-college educated white women are moving to Trump because of this, but it's significant enough of them that it's problematic for Trump. Simultaneously, there is some polling that is showing that the voters who did not come out in 2012 but did not come out in 2016 for the Democratic candidate may very well be motivated by this explicit of racism, right? Like, I can tell you that, do you remember Mike who worked downstairs here? How would you say he's late 20s, early 30s? African-American guy, late 20s, 30s, was working at, in the building as like I don't know what you call it, a concierge. Or
concierge. Door.
And I think he was an IT guy or he had some, I can't remember.
He had some other degree.
This is a day job.
He had other things going on.
When Trump won, came in, he's like, yeah, I'm not surprised. That's the way this country is. Yep. And I think there was a lot of African-Americans who had a similar response. Like, no kidding. And I think a lot of African-Americans did not come out in part. I mean, I don't know, you know, how narrowly you want to tailor what politics are. But... Hillary Clinton was just not doing the politics properly into motivated. Everything was transactional. Everything was top down. There was not necessarily, she was not emphasizing the material benefits that she was going to provide
and
to
not
voters.
Trusted because of her own record and rhetoric.
The Clinton's record was incredibly racist.
Yes. Yeah.
particularly with them, that's real. Right.
I mean, and that has changed over time. Bill Clinton was relatively, you know, relatively popular with the African-American vote. And I would say also, again, Clinton's relationships with older African-Americans, pretty strong. So, and I think there was an awareness of Trump's racism, but I think at one point, I don't know that we had a similar dynamic where Trump was like specifically targeting different African-Americans over and over again. And in the course of the past week, in fact, actually now the non-college educated white women are responding to his attacks on the squad. I wouldn't be surprised if AOC's background as a bartender is not helpful in this regard.
It's definitely helpful in this regard. And I just want to say, I think that there's no question that we talk about the real contradictory nature of a lot of the electorate. And I think that this is why Matt and I have been trying to emphasize so much that you really have to disaggregate between a hardcore of a Trump Republican base and some other people who may have any number of problematic attitudes, blah, 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 blah. But they don't like this. They don't like, and it's bearing in the poll.
I don't think there's that many of those people, but I think
but
there's some.
But they're geographically significantly distributed.
Exactly, yes. And which makes sense, right? I mean, it would make sense just in terms of very broad generalizations that someone living in Wisconsin might be more sensitive to overt racism than somebody, say, living in Alabama, with all due respect. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but I suspect that the data bears me out. But the real issue is, will it bring out African-Americans who stayed home during the Clinton-Trump race with Donald Trump going out there and getting all explicitly racist? I mean, super explicitly racist. And so we'll see. At the end of the day, this stuff is just sort of, I don't know, I don't want to say it's masturbatory, but I mean, that's part of, like, you know, why we do this, is just sort of give you a sense of what where we think things are. But at the end of the day, it's not going to make that much of a difference unless people get out there, organize, mobilize. So do that. And if that involves you traveling, I got good news. Segway. As you know, packing your toiletries somehow always involves a delicate game of stacking and space hacking, correct? That's why Quip electric toothbrushes work just as well at home as they do on the go. I don't know if this is an actual data point, but as far as I can tell, Quip is the most compact, does not involve a charger, tucks easily into your carry-on, into your backpack. Dental hygiene should not be just a function of staying overnight. It should be a daily thing, folks. Plus, the travel-ready cover acts as a stand. It mounts to hotel mirrors. It protects your brush from sandy swimsuits, luggage slip-ups. And the 3-month battery life will last through a season filled with weekends away. Brush heads are automatically delivered on a dentist recommended, and not just dentist recommended, but a SAM recommended schedule, which is once every 3 months for just $5. So you're always going to have fresh bristles. They're making it easier than ever to keep up with your wake up and wind down routine when you're out of the office. I have given a Quip to my sister. Unsolicited, she sends me a text saying, "I want you to know my dentist just complimented my teeth brushing since I got the Quip." It makes a huge difference, and I've said this many times before. You can buy whatever electric toothbrush you want. If you're not going to use it, it's not going to work. And the beauty of the Quip, to me, I mean, the design is very attractive, and it feels substantial but not too heavy. But the beauty is that it can sit right where your other toothbrushes used to sit because of its size. And so you're not charging it in a different room. You're not having to bring a charger when you travel. It's super convenient. And that's why I love Quip and why I'm taking it to, I guess I'm going to the beach later. I take it wherever I go.
Oh, good for you. You're going to
brush your teeth at the beach.
Well, in a couple weeks.
You brush, and that's also a good follow-up question. You brush your teeth at the beach.
I brush my teeth 3 times a day now. So
damn right.
Quip starts at just $25, and if you go to getquip.com/majority right now, you can get your first refill pack for free. That's your first refill pack for free at getquip.com/majority. Check it out. All right, let's get into this. Let's just do this Rush Limbaugh so that we can get this out of the way, and then we're going to do a little debate preview. Wow, Rush has done, he's had some work. He's just looking a little bit weird.
Oh, my God.
He's a smooth boy.
What a handsome fatso.
Oh, yeah.
I think Bernie's smooth. Damn.
No. And here
Wait,
he is.
Excuse you.
Now, listen, whenever, you? listen, this is important.
Spirit matters.
Whenever you're looking for someone to defend you from charges of racism, who better to defend you from charges of racism than Rush Limbaugh?
That's great.
And
I'm not racist. Asked by Fred Rush.
Exactly.
All that great Jesse Jackson mugshot material.
Oh.
He's obviously not racist. That's like me saying, I'm super patient. I never lose my cool. Ask my friend, Sam Cedar.
That's right. That's right. There you go.
And guess who's running these places? It's not just Baltimore. Go to any place. You know, there's certain things you're not supposed to say. You're not supposed to criticize anything the Democrats run. You're not supposed to criticize anything where minorities are involved because that's automatically labeled racist. But I want to tell you right up front, the president is not a racist. He didn't say anything racist. He didn't call anybody. He called Cummings a racist after Cummings reacted. But folks, look, Detroit, Flint, Los Angeles, San Francisco, massive homeless problems. Wherever you find this decadent decay.
Pause it. Right. Flint, incidentally, is the city where white governors, white state officials poisoned thousands of children, giving them future neurological problems that they'll never be able to recover from because of a combination of their desire to save money and their refusal to listen to the people, like a fundamentally anti-democratic move. So Flint, very hard to say. The mayor had no control, incidentally, I would add.
No.
And the notion of deindustrialization being a function of democratic policies in these specific cities is absurd. It's just absurd.
San Francisco, massive homeless problems. Wherever you find this decadent decay, you're going to...
It's a bit redundant, but whatever.
Decadent decay?
Find Democrats having run the operation or the city, the state, whatever it is, the county, for decades.
I'll remind you, I mean... What a load of hogwash this is. The idea that Democrats create homelessness, let's say, as opposed to just don't arrest people for being homeless. I'm looking now at the Rockefeller Institute for Government. It is the Who Gives and Who Gets page. Explore the balance of payments between states and the federal government. There are the balance of payments. There are some states that contribute more to the federal government than they get back. Those are Massachusetts, Connecticut, New Jersey, New York, Illinois, Washington State, Colorado, a couple others. The vast majority of the ones that are taking payments that are actually getting are controlled by Republicans, where money is coming in. I mean, so the idea that, you know, that there is problems as measured by sort of how much revenue is generated versus how much is spent, that there are problems with places specifically as a function of being governed by Democrats is absurd. There are urban environments that we have that have been systemically denied or have no political power, and they've been systemically denied the support structures that wealthier places have. Bottom line, poverty has been allowed to fester. It has been enhanced by racist policies going back decades in terms of housing, in terms of jobs. And these are severe problems in some of these cities. Also exists in rural areas. It's just that you have fewer people there.
Yeah, that's exactly right. But you see also a parallel, and it's fascinating because, I mean, obviously now we're in a major upsurge back thanks to certain people in the IDW of racism and IQ stuff. But if you properly understand Charles Murray, more broadly than just the racism, he's trying to be the public intellectual that justifies class stratification. And so his books, after the bell curve, he started writing on how poor white people had innate cultural losing ground was all about how people in Appalachia and so on were decadent and living in decay and didn't have the intelligence and the discipline to succeed in capitalism, because that's what all this stuff is first you deindustrialize, oppress, and everything else to these people, and then you have to build a narrative to justify. So that's actually all Trump's doing in his, like, crude, demagogic way. And I just want to say a brief...
Well, it's not also all that Trump's doing. That's why he got there.
And that's why he got there.
Because it's the flip side of... And we said this many times during the
tweets,
during the campaign, that when the Republican Party says you're immoral and that's why you're poor, the flip side of that is if you're the richest person on the stage, you are the most powerful and
deserving.
And deserving.
And that's why Mitt Romney and Donald Trump are the same thing in that respect.
Exactly. And it's why when Jeb Bush said anything, Donald Trump was just like, I'm a billionaire, supposedly. Right. And so according to the entire principles that you've established around the Republican Party and a worldview of conservatism, I'm better than you.
Right. I think that and also I just, this is less important, but I mean, the idea of calling Elijah Cummings, obviously I have very different politics or significantly different politics than Elijah Cummings, but I happen to, he's definitely my favorite member of the House Democratic leadership by far. And just going back a couple of months when there was that whole melodrama, when Rashida Tlaib did the whole, like, I forget what she's basically made a point about racist attitudes, even if you don't have, even if in your own awareness, you're not explicitly racist. And that guy on the committee cried and had a meltdown. I don't know if people are remembering this. Of course, it came out that he had, in fact, said multiple birther and racist comments. But Elijah Cummings, I mean, in a perfect distillation of all of these dynamics, basically comforted the guy. And the guy did a whole... Meadows, Mr. Chairman, you and I are friends and all this stuff. And Cummings actually was like, in fact, yeah, we are friends. But he had to psychologically comfort and protect this guy because he had a meltdown about her making a basic point about entirely race baiting exercise, which was all they were doing, by literally having a woman, a black woman from the Trump organization, stand mute, looking into space while they were like, look here, he can't be racist.
Meanwhile, Jeff Meadows, when he came out to, Mark Meadows, when Elijah Cummings was being attacked, Meadows, who was,
great personal friends.
Good friends. He came out and said, no one works harder for his district than Elijah. He's passionate about the people he represents. And no, Elijah is not a racist.
Oh, phew. I was really concerned about his reputation. Wow.
Really put
a second there.
I am absolutely.
What a buddy.
Yeah, right. I won't dignify that. I support my president, but what an atrocious, disgusting thing to say about my colleague and friends. Not like. Hey, let me tell you something. Elijah's one of the good ones, and he personally would not choose to live around rats. That's why he's in Congress. I got your back.
Exactly.
Pro tip to the new people in Congress. Maybe don't make friends with folks like that.
I know it's probably one of those things where he comes up to Cummings and it's like, I'm sorry about that. You know how it is with my crazies. I've got to, they're so crazy. I've got to really be racist. I'm sorry. Let's just preview the debate a little bit tonight. Start off with this this guy on CNN. This is, I think, I think this is sort of accurate in some way. Sort of, but there's one premise. Let's see if you can figure this out, what this premise is that is mistaken here, right? When he talks about Twitter Democrats.
Democratic Party right now, a real concern among some more centrist Democrats, establishment Democrats, that the party is moving too far left, that they're chasing Twitter headlines instead of where the majority of the American people may be. That concern exists in certain circles. And I think tonight there is going to be this, I would imagine, assertion from folks who are not in the center of the stage, who are more moderate, to try and make that case and appeal to that sensibility, that concern in some quarters of the party, that the policies that Warren and Sanders particularly are driving forth may be too far left. I will just say, Warren and Sanders have been fighting against that theory their entire political lives.
All right. Well, here's the problem with the whole theory that this guy postulates. If it was the case that it's just Twitter Democrats, as he says, that are driving this sort of push to the left, why is it that no one else on that stage will be polling in double digits other than Warren and Bernie Sanders? Like, I mean, and it's not even close. You got Buttigieg, I think, is around 7, maybe 8, probably closer to 7 on an average.
From 6 to 10.
I'm talking about the, yeah, you got to average these polls.
And 7 or 8, yep.
And then everyone else, no one, I think, breaks 3%. And that may be generous. So you have to ask yourself, if it's just about chasing Twitter, how is it that Twitter, and it's true, there's not a lot of people on political Twitter, as it were.
Certainly not 33%.
How is it possible that they are commanding between the two of them a plurality, it appears at this point, close to it, of the Democratic vote? How could that possibly be the case? On top of which, I still contend that I don't know that other than the labeling that is done by people like that and by the centrists, that people really care about the labels. It really is just sort of like how you wear it, I think.
They care about your instincts. They care about, I do think some policies have salience for people, but I agree with you. And I think, yeah, not only do people not care about labels broadly, I think you still see, depending on your, like in certain social environments, I see people wanting to claim the tag socialist when they are definitely not, because they perceive it as cool and trendy. And then in other social environments, I see people that are extremely left who still like to say, you know, I'm a moderate.
Also, who are these establishment voters that he keeps referencing? Like, I like it when they make people up and then you're like, oh, it's you.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I don't think it's him necessarily, but certainly the people who are espousing this, they're talking about themselves.
A lot of people are saying, well,
a lot of people are saying,
yeah, like, there's not a poll. I want to see some numbers on that.
Well, all that's right. What they always mean is they're small social groups. Because as I've said a gazillion times, like socially moderate and maybe even in some areas to the right and absolutely economically populist and left would be where you would find so-called swing voters. And they're always invariably talking about people that are, I wouldn't even say socially left. I would say quasi-socially tolerant and right-wing corporate economics.
All right, Kamala Harris is not going to be on tonight, so let's
tomorrow
play.
Night,
let's say
right?
that for tomorrow night. What's this? Who's this guy?
This is Robert Wolf, former economic advisor to President Obama.
All right, let's just do this one, and then one more point about Warren's got a proposal today that I imagine will come up in the debate. But this is the Road to 2020 on Fox News. This guy Wolf is going to blow. Is this Ainsley Earhart again?
Yeah.
Blow her mind with his description of the Democrats.
So
who's going to be fighting in the debate tonight? Who are they going to go after? Probably Warren, because she's ahead.
Yeah, I think right now on stage you have a bunch of moderates tonight. You have like Beto and Mayor Pete and Tim Ryan and Klobuchar, and it's easy to go
you
after.
You call them moderates?
Versus where Bernie and Warren are? I mean,
Buttigieg is not moderate.
I'm talking within the party. Okay. Well, he's not for Medicare for All. So there's a few things he hasn't been for. Same with Beto. So you have real debates, whether it's on open borders or Medicare for All or student loans that you guys were chatting about. And to me, you have to kind of punch up. But more importantly, you got to let people know what you stand for. And that's what the party's not doing enough of.
Now, the idea that the party's not doing, first of all, open borders, he's making that up.
Yeah, maybe the DSA convention.
But the idea of the party's not making it known what it stands for. There's literally a debate with 20 candidates, each one of them racing out with their policy proposals earlier and in more depth than I think I've ever seen. Compare this to what the Republican Party's last primary was like. I'm going to build a wall. And then Jeb Bush would say, well, I'm going to build a bigger wall. And then Marco Rubio would say, well, I'm going to build a thicker wall. That was basically the policy debate so this is just absurd. We're getting a good debate on policy. We're not seeing a ton of details on all these things, so it's a little bit difficult to sort of follow them on some respects. I can tell you that Kamala Harris's Medicare for All proposal is taking a bit of a hit, particularly on the 10-year waiting period, because people realize, like, wait, they did the math and they found out that if Barack Obama had tried to push the ACA with a 10-year window, then Donald Trump would have been the one who would have been responsible for implementing it. So that seems like a non-starter, exactly, from the get-go. The other interesting thing is, there was pushback from Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All folks saying that her plan's not really a Medicare for All. Now, the irony is...
They sent an email.
What's that?
They sent an email.
Yeah. The irony is that, as I've been saying in the past, that Bernie's Medicare for All bill is really like a Medicaid for All because it's more generous. It's more inclusive. It would be Medicare insofar as maybe the reimbursement rates would be closer in line with Medicare. More people would take it. More people are aware of it. But they specifically wanted to brand it Medicare because that doesn't have the stigma, apparently, that Medicaid does. So there's some brouhaha there where the Harris people are saying, well, yours is really a Medicaid for All, but this and that. It's at the end of the day... her proposal was, I think, put out in many respects to seem like a moderate version of Bernie's plan, when in fact it was just one that does not appear to make sense because of it. The 10-year thing doesn't make sense, and the Medicare Advantage element of it doesn't make sense because people go to Medicare Advantage because it's more generous, not so much if you get really sick, but it's more generous if you don't get really sick. But Bernie's version of the Medicare for All plan would provide those things, so it doesn't quite make any sense. But
can I just say really briefly too that the phase in is a matter of lives too. I mean, you elongate that, you're putting more people's lives at risk. The same way that Joe Biden's just unbelievable lies and fear mongering, even under Obamacare, which I'm the first to admit that's not what I want, but of course has improved healthcare. There's still tens of millions of people without health insurance, and there's still plenty of people who have health insurance but don't properly use it because they can't afford deductibles so on.
And can I just say, I'm really glad that Bernie is pushing back on this and showing where they differ on this policy, because that's the kind of thing that we were hoping he would do going into the first debate and maybe didn't do so well.
Well, she didn't have a proposal at that time.
Yeah.
Also, I should tell you, before we get into the debate tonight, Warren apparently has come out with a plan on trade, which involves 9 separate criteria in which a country would have to meet before negotiating a trade deal with the U.S. They have to uphold and enforce labor rights laid out by the International Labor Organization. They eliminate all domestic fossil fuel subsidies, fulfilling commitments from the Paris Climate Change, not running afoul of the State Department's country reports on human rights, not being on the Treasury Department's list for manipulative currencies and before more. It certainly would be a departure from where we are in terms of trade in the past. I mean, I think Bernie has signaled, broadly speaking, that he didn't like the existing trade structures that we have, but I don't know that he's come out with a specific proactive plan as of yet. But we will hear more of that tonight. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I'm going to be talking to Nicholas Sarwark and the Fun Half, the 19th and current chair of the Libertarian National Committee. I want to remind you, if you want to join us and listen to this, you can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Once you become a member, you'll immediately have access to all of our archives. And it'll be searchable on the app. It's the easiest place to look for it. Just log in on the app as a member. Search any keyword, libertarian. All the libertarian stuff will pop up. This one, of course, will be there. And you get the whole show commercial free. You know the whole deal. Become a member today. Join themajorityreport.com. Don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Thank you for all the notes about the AM quickie. I'm glad you like it. We're going to continue to do it. At one point, we're going to put it on its own feed like a little birdie. It's going to fly from the nest, but not quite yet. Probably closer to September now we're talking. But in the meantime, check it out. It's on your feed as it exists now. And Michael.
Yes, sir.
Last night
we had on Brooke Thomas from TYT. Very fun. We talked about understanding the Central Park Five as, like, you could use that as the sort of key to understand Trump and tabloid culture. We also got into the Mafia QAnon story. Really broad, wide-ranging interview with Celso Amorim, who's author of Acting Globally, Brazil's Assertive Foreign Policy. He was Lula's foreign minister, Dilma Rousseff's defense minister. We talked about the failure of globalization, the rise of the far right, and the state of Lula's imprisonment. Then went over Rogan and Cornel West. Whole bunch of other stuff, obviously. This weekend, an illicit history of what's happening in Hong Kong with Elaine Koo, who's a reporter there. Michael Brooks' show on YouTube, patreon.com/TMBS. I want to thank everybody. We've met big targets this month. We've got over 2,500 patrons, which was the goal, and we crossed our first 60,000 on YouTube. So really appreciate it.
Jamie.
This week on the Antifada, I talked with Leslie Lee III from Struggle Session about the movie Midsommar, and that's coming out tomorrow. So if you haven't seen the movie yet, you should probably see it right now before we spoil it for you. Although I feel like a lot of stuff that happens in that movie is fairly predictable. But anyway.
Yay or nay?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, it's a yeah.
Hell yeah. I think it's better than Hereditary, actually. It's a good follow-up to Hereditary. And also, I've got an episode of my little side project, The Vampire Castle, with Leslie as well, coming out next week, I think. It's for patrons. So if you want to hear us talk about vampires, you should probably be a patron to one or both of our shows. And also, we still have the episode from last week that I'm very stoked about, wherein I speak with Tithi Bhattacharya and Chinzia Arutsa about their amazing book, Feminism for the 99%, A Manifesto.
Matt.
A literary hangover. We did James Fenimore Cooper's The Pioneers, which, if you like to read literature from a Marxist perspective, it's probably the best I've covered. Talks about settling central New York and how important commodification was to that process. Basically, the myth is that people are pioneers because of they landlords want to give them freedom, or we have the pilgrims or whatever, but really it's because we want to commodify things. And in central New York, it was maple trees. And there's two things you can do with maple trees. You can either tap them for maple sugar, which is a longer process, but the trees can renew every year, or you can just burn them for potash and sell that to Europe for fertilizer. That's a bit of a shorter term, but faster money, and you can guess which one was done.
Potash! See you in the Fun Half, and we will be talking to the chair of the Libertarian Party.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2. 5/8. 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Rand Paul.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good. Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook. Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!